Why are humans so distractible, and why do we throw good money after bad or eat cake when we know we should be dieting? Well, according to Gary Marcus, professor of psychology at New York University, it's because our brains are a lot clumsier than we think they are. In fact, he says, the brain is really a haphazard collection of spare parts. He's written a book called Klug, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind, published by Houghton Mifflin. I'm delighted that it has brought Gary Marcus back to the show today. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, have I pronounced that right? K-L-U-G-E? I always thought that was the name of some multimillionaire.
It is. I'm not sure how he pronounces it, but the word that I'm using, which is an old engineer's bit of slang, we in this country pronounce kludge. Brits, I am told, pronounce it kludge. But I like to rhyme it with stooge because it kind of stooge kind of gets across the idea, which is this haphazard, clumsy, sort of works, sort of doesn't kind of thing.
And a kludge is haphazard? It's something that's just sort of thrown together?
Exactly. I like to think of MacGyver or Rube Goldberg or something like that, a collection of spare parts that gets the job done, duct tape, rubber bands, baling wire.
Now, why would it be that way? After all, we are the end of a millions and millions of years of evolution, and there are some pretty efficient predecessors.
Well, that's exactly the question that I take on in the book. If evolution is so good, then how come the mind is so clumsy? And a lot of people's first instinct is the same as yours. Well, if evolution has had such a long time to work on things, why aren't things really good? And the first part of the answer is evolution has had a long time to work on some things, like our visual systems have developed over hundreds of millions of years. But the things that we think of as uniquely human, like language and the ability to sit around and have conversations like these, those things are only more like 100,000 years old. So there's been a lot less time for debugging. That's part of the answer. And the other part of the answer is that evolution isn't really an optimizer, but more like something that climbs hills in a very complicated terrain. Sometimes it gets to the top of the mountain, but sometimes there's a distant mountain, and evolution can't see that distant mountain. So in technical terms, there's a local maximum. You get to a peak that's high, but not the highest. So evolution usually does a good job, but there's no guarantee, since it can't look out ahead, that it's going to do a perfect job.
Evolution has given us a certain hardwired response to language, but every one of us has to learn how to read because our brain really never developed the reading aspect.
That's right. Reading itself is sort of a kludge. I mean, you're taking the sounds of a language and you're forcing them into some kind of writing system. Different languages do that in different kinds of ways. And as you said, it doesn't come as naturally to the human mind. So everybody learns language. That's sort of more deeply ingrained in our genes. But learning to read requires us to do this sort of unnatural mapping between vision and hearing. And not everybody learns it. You need practice. You need good educational structure and so forth.
Does your background help us understand this at all? Is it instructive? You were a high school dropout, weren't you?
I was a high school dropout. I
went because of the kludginess of your brain?
I think it was because of the kludginess of the schools, really. The schools weren't really keeping me that entertained, shall we say. And so I went directly to Hampshire College, which had a small cognitive science program. And I've been working on cognitive science ever since. I did cognitive science with Steven Pinker as a graduate student, and I've been teaching at NYU for the last several years.
You were at MIT.
Yeah, that's where I did my PhD.
So we have this brain that you said is capable of doing certain things quite well, but very inefficient in other areas. Where is it most inefficient?
I think memory is sort of the cardinal sin of evolution and of the human mind. So our memory systems are good, but they could have been a lot better. We can sort of store anything we want. We have a lot of trouble retrieving particular bits of information. So if I ask you what you had for breakfast yesterday, it's not very long ago, but you might have a really hard time remembering it because there are too many yesterdays and too many breakfasts. So you confuse, you know, this day was granola and this day was cereal and so forth.
I'm good on yesterday's breakfast.
You're good
but don't
on
ask
yesterday's
me 2
breakfast.
Days ago.
2 days goes too far. So if people not in New York City perhaps park in the same garage every day, then they remember roughly the general tendency. I'm in that garage, but they confuse the particular place within the garage. So one of the problems with our memory system is we really easily confuse together things that are similar. My favorite example of this is skydivers. Skydivers, if they're pulling the ripcord many times, they might forget, did I do it on this day? And so a pilot can remember the landing gear by using a checklist, but a skydiver can't use a checklist. And so it turns out that 6% of all skydiving fatalities are people that simply forgot to pull the ripcord. You know, if you were to believe in intelligent design, I think that's, you know, a good counterexample, unintelligent design, that our memory is not precise enough to remember something as important as that.
I think people who, for example, if you have to take 3 pills a day, one in the morning, one at 6 o'clock in the evening, and then before you go to sleep, I know I've had experiences along these lines. Did I take that pill this morning?
Exactly. It's exactly that kind of memory where it's the same thing over and over. So if it were just once, you'd remember it no problem. But if it's every day, that's why, you know, these pill boxes, and now they have like digital pill boxes, are really useful as a way of kludging the mind, right, of out-kludging the kludge.
Now, why is this? We understand the process of memory now and the whole hippocampus thing and all of that. Isn't it a pretty efficient process?
Well, we understand part of it. There's part of it we don't really understand. So we understand, you know, that the hippocampus is involved and the frontal lobes are involved, but we don't know where particular memories are stored, and I don't think the brain does either, and that's the difference between our memories and computer memories. So in a computer, you can assign everything that you need to remember to a particular location. So you could have a register that stored today's pill, a register for yesterday's pill, and so forth, and it'd be perfectly distinct. But for us, all those memories get blurred together. We don't know where they are. The brain doesn't know where yesterday's pill taking is stored as opposed to the day before. The brain just has to kind of pull things out by rough reminders. There's no master map like there is in a computer. And so we as scientists don't really understand the details, and there's a way in which the brain itself doesn't understand the details. The brain itself doesn't know exactly where things are stored, and so they can get confused together. So like I said, I think that's one of the biggest errors that evolution made. It could have built us memory like computers have, and then we would be much more precise and we wouldn't have these sort of brain farts.
You mentioned earlier that the intelligent design people say that we are at the highest point because the designer really...
He's perfect in his image.
Yeah.
So
you would argue against intelligent design by saying, just look at the human brain?
Exactly.
That came up with the idea of intelligent design?
I would say that I would look at Groucho Marx. He said, who are you going to believe, me or your own eyes? You know, there's this nice fantasy that our minds are perfect. But reality is that our minds are more sophisticated than, say, cats and dogs. But that doesn't mean that they're perfect. There are lots of things we don't do well. Our memories aren't very good. There's a new study coming out tomorrow that talks about voters. And if you vote inside of a school as opposed to an office building, then you're more likely to favor school policies. So we're contaminated by all kinds of little things. So there are all kinds of ways in which our memory, our reasoning, our choices, they're all contaminated in different kinds of ways, which is not intelligent design.
My guest is Gary Marcus, who is a professor of psychology at NYU. His book, Kludge, The Haphazard Construction of the Mind, or the Human Mind. I almost screwed that up because
you almost they're kludged.
Because the designer played a little game with me there.
That's true.
It is published by Houghton Mifflin. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, let's talk about some of the other things that that you deal with here. For example, I mentioned in the introduction throwing good money after bad. Well, is that because our brain is haphazard, or is that just simply because we live with certain misconceptions?
We're not really rational about our decision-making. We have emotional investment in things. So, I mean, probably this might be politically controversial, but certainly not in Manhattan. The biggest example of throwing good money after bad might be the Iraq War. So it was probably originally a bad idea, and then Bush, because he's committed to it, is forced to just keep going there. And that happens all the time. It doesn't just happen to presidents. It happens to all of us.
And voters said during the 2004 election, voters who thought the war was a mistake said, well, but we shouldn't change horses in midstream.
Yeah, that was Bush's line, is I'm the decider and I'm going to stick with it, which is exactly to be committed to throwing good money after bad. It's a very odd line. It's surprising that people should accept that.
Is this something that occurs in all cultures? Do we see different kind of kludges in different cultures?
I think that you see kludges in all kinds of cultures. So another kind of evidence of kludge is the fact that people are subject to mental illness, for example. And you see schizophrenia, for example, in every culture. It's about 1% in any society. So there are individual things that particular cultures do that I think are pretty silly, that you could call them kludges. But most of what I write about is stuff that's sort of universally true of the human mind, things that just aren't quite wired correctly. Culture can sometimes help us work around that, and sometimes culture takes a bad idea and people stick with the bad idea for a while.
Well, with something like schizophrenia, we talk about it as being a chemical problem. And then you talked about wiring. Are the two connected to each other? And is this part of what makes the brain a kludge?
Sure. I mean, you can talk about all of these things at a brain level or a psychological level. I'm a psychologist, so I'll tend to talk about them at a psychological level. I'll give you an example is depression. One of the psychological contributors, and you can talk all about receptors and receptor chemistry if you like, but one of the psychological contributors is, again, the nature of memory. So the way our memory works is we use cues and reminders. We remember similar things. So if you're feeling bad, you have a bad day at work, you come home, you think about other bad days at work, and then you think about, you know, a fight that you had with your partner, and the next thing you know, you're like putting on blues songs and listening to breakup songs, and it's just a spiral. Things get worse and worse. So that's a psychological mechanism that contributes to depression, and it can actually be traced to the memory kludge that I was talking about in the first place, where our minds are not very good at being systematic about looking at things and saying, is this what happened?
So we actually make that decision to make the situation worse.
Well, not consciously, but unconsciously. It's the unconscious effect of memory that leads you to find more things that are similar to the thing that I'm already thinking about now, instead of doing what a pollster would do, which was to say, is this a representative sample of my memories? We're not good at that.
I have found myself with a piece of cake or some other dessert and thinking, well, I really, in fact, this is almost going to make me sick if I take another bite because it's just too sweet or I've had enough anyway. And then I take that extra bite.
That's right. I think that the central emotion of human beings, or the one that's like most distinct, is chagrin. We're smart enough to make long-term plans, like I'm going to cut down on, you know, fatty foods, and then we're dumb enough to, when we see the chocolate cake, we just go ahead and do it anyway. And that reflects a kludge that Freud first saw, which is this sort of split between ancestral mechanisms and modern mechanisms. So the old parts of our brain are all about sort of short-term gratification. The modern ones are about long-term plans, and they don't communicate very well.
Can we trace all of this to points in our evolutionary history?
I think so. So, I mean, I think in particular one of the big changes in our evolutionary history was these modern systems that are more clever, but they were just sort of grafted on top of the older systems. So somewhere in the last million years or 100,000 years, we grew some new mechanisms that allow us to think about long-term things. No other animal can really do it in the same way. But all those old mechanisms are still there. And the heart of the kludginess is what I call evolutionary inertia, which is like Newton has this idea of inertia. An object that's in motion tends to stay in motion. Well, evolution, once it's in a particular direction, continues in that direction. So once it
even if it's not doing very well by us.
Exactly. So the memory stuff that I was talking about is like that. The kind of memory that we have works great for creatures that don't need to give you eyewitness testimony or remember where their car keys are and stuff like that. But it's lousy for, you know, modern human beings that need a lot of specific detail. But evolution had this old mechanism as a kind of off-the-shelf spare part, and it just runs with that. And that's the essence of making kludges, is when you're just using the spare parts.
Well, why hasn't evolution kept up with the changes in human needs? I would think that there would be people who'd be really great at remembering where the car keys are.
There's some individual variation, but I think it's sort of you have a very bad fundamental design, and all you can do is tweak it a little bit one way or the other. And people can learn tricks. They can out-kludge the kludge, so they can use, for example, the famous method of the loci, where you associate things with particular rooms that you know in a building that you know well. So you can find little tricks to kind of help you around the edges. But the basic design of the human mind, I don't think, has changed that much in the last 100,000 years. Evolution works too slowly for that. And there's too much of this inertia. There's too much already in one direction. You really have to start over and actually intelligently engineer it to get rid of some of these issues.
So is my brain better engineered for surviving in the savanna?
It's probably in some ways better for the savannah. You're probably better off in modern society because
I've never even been to savannah.
To Savannah, Georgia. Sherman was there at the end of his march, I guess. Modern medicine, for example, makes it much more likely that you can do something kludgy and get away with it. So it's a trade-off.
My guest is Gary Marcus, who's written a book called Kludge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Gary Marcus, who's a professor of psychology at New York University and director of the NYU Infant Language Learning Center. And he has written extensively for any number of publications. He is the author of The Birth of the Mind and also editor of the Norton Psychology Reader. His latest book is called Kludge, and it has, which is defined as a clumsy or inelegant solution to a problem. It is published by Houghton Mifflin. And we were Since you're somebody who's also thought about the infant mind, do we start seeing the effects of the kludge very early in human development?
That's a very interesting question that I should have a good answer to, but I don't, for a principled reason, which is that most of the things that we can use to evaluate kludginess are experiments that we want to do with adults, or at least like 3- and 4-year-old children, where they're verbal. And my day job, as it were, is looking at preverbal infants, and it's hard to sort of get at some of these questions. But I bet.
But there's debate even there. And ever since Noam Chomsky came up with his theory, people have been arguing over just how we do acquire language.
Absolutely. That's sort of what my day job is about. And I tend to be on the side that said that there's a fair amount of innate structure. There's something built into the mind that allows us to learn language. Although I differ from Chomsky in that I think that it's not as special to language as Chomsky talks about. Chomsky's talked about a language acquisition device. And I think that learning language is more like learning other skills than maybe Chomsky does.
A listener named Jenny left a comment on our show page saying, there's a good argument that the brain's inefficiency is its strongest asset because it allows for constant surprise learning and development via accidental association and more integration of formerly seeming illogical things. Does that make sense to you? She says also it's more protective against damage that other areas take over when one or another is hurt.
Well, I think there are a couple ideas there that are brought together there. One is about the fact that the brain has plasticity, that it can repair itself, which I think is very important. I don't think that that takes away, though, from the fundamental errors in the design. So all of our body has different ways of repairing itself, and they're pretty good. They're not as good as, say, a salamander. So a salamander can regrow a lost limb. So compared to salamanders, we're pikers or something like that. We're not so good at the regeneration, but we can do some things. People can recover from strokes to some extent and so forth. So one issue there is about regeneration, and we're able to do some of that. The other issue is about, well, are the sort of fallacy or sort of limits things that make us better off in the long term? So one example I hear about that a lot is, well, but don't we forget the things that we don't want to remember? And the reality, I'm afraid, is not so Pollyanna-ish. So Freud sort of cast this virus on the mind, saying that we can repress memories. But if you look at, say, soldiers coming back from war, I was just reading a Civil War biography, which is why I was able to mention Sherman a moment ago. There are quotes in the Ken Burns book about a soldier spent 50 years trying to forget what happened, or people coming back from the Holocaust. So we can't actually forget the memories that we want to forget. We forget the things we do want to remember, like pulling the ripcord. It's a little bit unrealistic.
We also forget things that are less important to us. For example, I may very well remember something for a long period of time and then stop thinking about it. It no longer becomes something that a telephone number, for example, that I would dial all the time. Then I haven't dialed it for a while and I forget it. And then I have to relearn it.
That's right.
Relearn it. And then, of course, it's there. I'm not sure whether I'm accessing the old memory or whether I'm just creating a new memory.
My guess is that it's all about access rather than storage. So the number is there, and then we have what's called savings. You forget it, and then it's a little bit easier, a little bit easier to remember it the second time around. So it's about finding tricks to make things come to mind quickly. It's sort of all there. Sometimes I think our memory is like a shoebox of old photographs where it's all in the shoebox, but the trick is to kind of find what you want when you need it. And that's what's inefficient about the mind. It could have been structured more like Google, where whatever it needs, there's this master map where it can go straight to it.
Well, we do have Google. We have computers. We are now capable of creating brains, in effect, that are a lot more efficient than the human brain, and yet we can create brains that do things that the human brain does. So is the inefficiency also an asset? Does it allow us to do the things that computers can't do?
It's an interesting question. So there are some things we do very well, some things machines do very well. So machines, I think, have us beat on memory. We have machines beat on perception, so we're better able to look out at the world and see a scene, like if we're driving. At the moment, I wouldn't trust a machine to drive. Probably in 10 or 20 years, they will be better than us at that. But for now, we're still better than the machines at like recognizing, is that a shadow or is that actually a child on a bicycle? So there are some things machines are better, some things we're better. I think that what we can do now is we can use machines as a reference point. We can compare and say, are there things that they do better? We can use people. I think that a search engine like Google kind of combines the best of both worlds. It takes some of the memory access mechanisms of human beings, but it combines them with this underlying substrate that computers have. I think the trick ultimately is not to say, well, one's better than the other, but rather what can we learn from one to make the other? And people who are building the machines can learn things from the people too.
We're told that our brains are very plastic. Could our brains become less haphazard through plasticity?
I think they do and they don't. I mean, I think that the fact that we can learn from culture is what helps us survive despite the fact that we're pretty kludgy. Plasticity allows that. But on the other hand, you could look at the details of how our memories work and how our learning works and so forth. And I think you would find that they could be a lot better. So we have trouble remembering things when we learn them just a few times. And I think the biggest problem with schools is that what children learn at school doesn't necessarily generalize to the real world. So we're plastic, but we're maybe not plastic enough.
So we're in the situation where we're kind of adjusting to the strengths and weaknesses of our brains. But we've done pretty well, haven't we? Or can we blame all of the problems? You mentioned the Iraq War, for example. In fact, the 20th century was the bloodiest century of all time, despite the fact that we are supposed to have evolved as a species.
I mean, I wouldn't want to put a number on it and say we're 20% kludgy or 80% kludgy. The way that I think about it is we want to recognize what our weaknesses are so we can improve them, whether they are 20% or 80%. I think maybe the single worst one that relates to what you were just asking about is called confirmation bias. And this is the idea that if you have a theory, you tend to notice the evidence that supports that theory. You don't notice the evidence that goes against it. And that leads to all kinds of problems. So politically, you know, you get convinced that your candidate is the one true candidate, and you have trouble seeing the arguments on the other side. That happens in religion. So lots of people think their deity is the one true deity. So our tendency to notice evidence for our own theories and to dismiss evidence for other theories or not even to notice it is a pretty serious problem.
And why? And that's because of the way the brain is structured?
I think that goes back once again to memory. I told you memory is sort of the linchpin of it all. Memory,
you say it's the mother of all kludges.
Exactly. Memory is the mother of all kludges because the things that you reason about are all filtered through memory. Computer programmers talk about garbage in, garbage out. And that's the idea that you can have a perfect program, but if the memory that it works on, the data that it works on is inaccurate, you wind up in a bad place. And that can happen a lot of times. I'll give you a simple domestic example. You ask two people who share an apartment, what percentage of the dishes do you do? One person tells you 70, the other person tells you 75. It's always going to add up to more than 100%. Well, what's going on there? It's easier to remember what you did than the other guy did, and we're not very good at compensating for that. We're not good at saying, well, it's easier for me, so maybe I should round down. I mean, a pollster knows how to do that, but the average person doesn't think about that, and so that leads to a lot of conflict.
What about people who have really good memories? I mean, I've always prided myself in having a very good memory. Sometimes it's led me to problems with loved ones where we are recalling a conversation of the past, and I mm-hmm. seem to remember so many more details, usually embarrassing to the other person, than the other person remembers. But I also, just in doing this job here, I remember things that I heard 10, 15, 25 years ago.
As a regular listener, I can vouch for that, for your phenomenal memory. I think that there is individual variation again, but still some of the basic structures. So I mean, you said that you could remember breakfast from yesterday, but maybe not so many days before. So
it just happens that I remember yesterday. People will ask me, what was on your show today? And I'll
scratch your head.
Forget.
I mean, I would imagine that's especially hard for you because you do so many of the shows. And so it's probably hard for you to remember, you know, which was on which day. You could say, sure, I had, you know, Jimmy Carter recently, but you might not be able to say, you know, on which particular day. So the sort of fault lines of memory are going to be the same for everybody, even if some people are a little bit better at the details than others.
What about people who have memory problems like amnesiacs? Or is there really such a thing as amnesia?
Oh, definitely there is. I mean, you know, if you injure the right parts, or maybe you want to think of the wrong parts of the brain, then absolutely you can get to situations where people can't get the information out. The most common form of amnesia actually goes away. So it's again a problem of access, that temporarily people can't access things. And then they come back. So after a traumatic brain injury, people might forget everything that happened, you know, within a few weeks, but eventually most of it comes back.
My guest is Gary Marcus, who's written a book called Kludge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind, published by Houghton Mifflin. Where does the word kludge actually come from?
There's a bit of debate about that. I trace it to engineers in the 1950s and 60s because my dad was one of those engineers. He picked it up at MIT when somebody said to him that the gadget that he was building, he said, Marcus, that's a kludge. As a sort of disparaging kind of term. Before that, a lot of people think it goes back to the German word kluge, which is clever. So the idea is that sometimes a kluge is a very clever way of getting a job done. It's not elegant. On my website, I have an example of a graduate student put an air conditioner from a house on top of his car to cool off the car. So it's not very elegant. He's not going to meet a lot of girls because he has a slick-looking ride, but it gets the job done. So in that sense, it's kind of clever. So that might be the etymology. There's some other controversial candidates. Like there's a Scottish word, klugi, which is outhouse. And you can also kind of see the connection there.
Last week, we talked about brainwashing on the show. And I guess we finally decided that there is no such thing as brainwashing, but there can be a lot of manipulation.
Tons of manipulation, for sure.
And you were talking about manipulation in terms of belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
So that works the other way, too. If I join a cult, let's say. Now, I've chosen to join the cult or somehow slipped into that cult. If I'm not open to what they have to tell me, no matter what they say, I'm not going to go along with it.
I mean, I think that's probably right. So people vary in their suggestibility. And I think that once somebody's in a direction, it's easy to accelerate in that direction. So there's a kind of mental inertia as well, where if you start believing, you know, in miracles, you notice the miracles, you don't notice the non-miracles, and things accelerate. If you were forced, dragged, kicking and screaming into a cult, you'd probably have the opposite confirmation bias. You would notice all the things that make the cult stupid, and you might not even notice that actually the people within the cult get along pretty well, or, you know, whatever the nice thing about it might be. I mean, even the worst cult probably has some virtue or nobody would join it, and you probably
Katie
wouldn't
Holmes.
Notice those things. Right, no comment.
Well, a listener wants to know about why we're said to only use a small portion of our brains. Is that part of the kludgeness?
I think that's true and not actually that kludgy. So it turns out that old statistic has some truth to it. I don't know the exact number, but that you only use 10% of the brain. But it's misleading. What it really means is the way the brain gets its job done is it switches on and off different parts. So to do any one thing, you need to do the motor part of your brain or the visual part of your brain. It would actually be energetically too expensive to use all of your brain at once. And so the compromise that I think is a good one is that evolution sort of outsources different problems to different parts of the brain.
Is this different for men and women? Because I've been told that women's brains tend to universalize more than men. Men's tend to be...
He says universalize. There are some gender differences.
And so with a stroke, for example, women are often more capable of overcoming some of the problems of a stroke than men, where the specific ability is located in only one part of their brain.
Mm-hmm. I don't know enough about the details on that particular one to say a lot, but there are some mild gender differences in terms of which pieces of the brain get used more often. They tend to be overlapping bell curves, so it's differences on average, but it's not differences for every individual.
Now, there is a book recently about trusting your gut.
Mm-hmm.
Is the gut reaction part of our kluginess?
I think that we actually trust our guts a little bit too much. So you think about like Malcolm Gladwell's book Blink. A lot of the examples where people actually make good instinctive decisions are cases where people know a whole lot about the domain they're looking at. So he talks, for example, about this person at the Getty Museum recognizing that a statue was a fake. Well, that person had been studying the statues for many, many years. So there are some cases where it's worth trusting our guts and some where it's not. Our guts are pretty good at sort of weighing a bunch of conflicting data, but they're not very good at making rational, deliberate kinds of decisions. So it's more complicated. It's not a one-liner, trust your gut or not. Better is to realize when your gut does a good job and when it does a bad job. So your gut does a bad job when it comes to controlling your diet. But it does a good job when it comes to maybe balancing 8 conflicting constraints and deciding which apartment you like. So your gut's probably good in telling you what apartment you like, but a little bit suspicious in telling you whether you should have dessert.
You read an article in the New York Times saying that we can improve our memory by using neuroprosthetics.
That we might ultimately be able to do that.
Yeah, what would that mean?
I think you could imagine basically Google on board, that you could imagine a memory chip that would organize your own memories or search your own memories in something like the way that Google or another search engine does, where you would index your own memories as well as the memories from the outside world.
You have a You have an event that you're about to do tonight?
That's right. Tomorrow night.
Tomorrow night.
Tuesday night at 6:30 at the American Museum of Natural History.
And is that the ideal venue for a discussion of this sort?
I think it's a great forum. I'll be happy to take more questions there. And, yeah, I think it's a wonderful venue.
Actually, people can find out more about that by going to our show page at WNYC.org. Now, what has been the response to this for people in the field? Do most people agree, most psychologists agree, that there is a kludginess in our brain?
I think that a lot of them do. I think that from the point of the professionals in the field, the interesting question is about evolutionary psychology, which is often talked about the mind as being optimal. And once I make the arguments, I think people realize that that's not really quite the right perspective, that sometimes evolution optimizes things, but really evolution is just interested in making things good enough. And sometimes they wind up sort of good enough but not great. And I think that the people in the field have responded pretty well to that.
In case you have a short-term memory problem, Gary Marcus will be speaking tomorrow at 6:30 at the American Museum of Natural History at 79th Street and Central Park West. For more information on that, you can go to our show page at WNYC.org. His book, Kludge, The Haphazard Construction of the Human Mind, is published by Houghton Mifflin. I want to thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks for having me again.